Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
Oh, it continues to get more and more interesting, and we're going to dig deep into it, this time from the perspective of the law, the legal end of it. We got former prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis with us. Eric, I'm just going to throw it out to you initially, because everybody has different points of this trial that's been standing out to them since we last talked. What to you has been, you know, one or some of the more poignant moments here in the trial of Karen Reed?
Certainly the cell phone expert comes to mind. I think they did a much better job of explaining to the jury the cell phone coordinates and what that means about where John O'Keefe likely was. Now, that was a challenge on cross-examination, and defense scored a few points there. And I think overall, just the prosecution's preparation, the witnesses, Jed McCabe, she kept her composure and just a really more streamlined and effective presentation by the state so far.
Very much so. McCabe really did keep it together pretty well as they were coming at her. Didn't get super emotional, just really stayed, to the facts. And I think played pretty well in front of that jury, despite them trying to tear her down, as obviously that is their job to do. I thought it was really interesting when they were talking to her about her emotions as the events were unfolding, as she's trying to call 911, what was going through her mind in those seconds. Let's take a look at some of that testimony from the trial. This is
when you were speaking to 911 that morning and during that event, how did you feel?
Extremely nervous, anxious, scared, uncertain, panicked.
Do you think your heartbeat was up?
Yes.
At 2:27, the night before, or around that time when you were looking up Hockamock before you went to bed, were you of the same state of mind of fear and panic, or were you in a very different state of mind?
I was relaxed, just playing on my phone, looking up things before I went to bed.
When you made a search for how long to die in the cold, or how long to die in cold, is that something that you thought of for yourself?
Now.
Why did you do it?
Miss Reed asked me to Google it.
And when was that?
That was in the morning after we found him.
And had you ever attempted either of those searches before Miss Reed asked you to do that?
No, I didn't.
You were asked questions about the next day when you visited the O'Keefe home and you read some records. Do you remember those questions?
Yes.
Do you remember going to the O'Keefe home?
I do, yes.
You went with who?
With Carrie and our two daughters.
You remember how many hours you spent with the O'Keefe family?
I don't remember how many hours, say a few.
Was it over 3 or 4?
Could have been, I'm not sure.
So there we go. We have her, I'm not getting anything weird out of this. I'm not getting, let's go cover a conspiracy because we killed him last night and put him out there. No, I mean, it's very much, you know, she talks about the emotion she felt. She goes and spends time with the family literally the next day because she cares about their well-being and them grieving through something this horrible. I mean, is a jury seeing this as an evil conspirator killing John O'Keefe?
It's a super important question because really the defense of this whole conspiracy hangs in the balance. And Jed McCabe's testimony is pretty contradictory to it. So that search of how long to die in the cold, that was central to the defense's arguments. And then Jen McCabe on the stand pretty much told in a straightforward fashion why she did that. It was because of Karen Reed. It's because Karen Reed asked her to do that. You know, she's presenting as not like someone who has something to hide or is concealing something. She's kind of presenting as someone who was caught in the chaos of all this and, you know, did the best she could to address it and her friend's death.
Well, and it's the only plausible explanation as well. I mean, take everything out of this and just go, okay, what's more likely for somebody to be looking up how long to die in the cold? Is it on Saturday night after everybody leaves the party and you're looking up basketball scores and planning your next day and you got your good friend out on the front lawn dying? Let's just see how long he still has. Okay, take the melatonin, time to go to bed. Is that what's happening, or is it the next morning when you're out there in a panic and Karen's screaming, how long has he been in the cold or something to that nature? And everybody's trying to figure this out, that you'd be searching that then. Which one's more plausible? I know one is, the other's not. And that's what the jury's going to have to look at too, because one makes sense, the other just doesn't.
That's the thing, is the jury is going to receive these conflicting stories, conflicting testimony, conflicting evidence. They're going to have to parse that out and decide, hey, what is most plausible? What is most consistent with common sense? What lines up with the objective evidence, with the other testimony I'm going to hear? And like you said, when the defense's conspiracy argument is placed under that kind of scrutiny, it really starts to raise some eyebrows. And for some folks, it's not going to pass the smell test.
How do you think the defense is coming across when they're doing things like
so
this?
The answer is always going to be the same. If you ask me who I spoke to, I'm always going to tell you I spoke to Miss Reed and Julie. I called Julie Albert and I called Tom Beattie. The answer is always the same, but the way the question asked and maybe some of the words that I use may be different. And I don't remember on specific days. We've been questioned many times, but the answers are always going to be the same. The wording may be different.
Yeah. Finish? Does that answer?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I'm going to allow that, but let's move on.
I'm trying, all right. When the Commonwealth asked questions about who you contacted that morning at the grand jury, you didn't need to have your recollection refreshed with anything. You said, I talked to Karen Reed, I called Julie Albert, I called Tommy, correct?
Correct.
And that's exactly what you told Trooper Prince as well. Karen Reed, Julie Albert, Tom Beattie. Is that right?
Yes, correct.
But you did make another phone call that morning that you left out of both of those statements, didn't you?
I'm not sure.
At 5:07 a.m., you called over to 34 Fairview, didn't you?
If it's in my phone record, then I must have.
It's in your phone records that you're aware of. Well, let me ask it a different way. You're aware that your phone records actually show that at 5:07, you called the 34 Fairview Nicole Albert's phone.
Correct.
It shows also that that call lasted 38 seconds, correct?
I'm not sure what it shows.
Just the digging. You done? Is that your answer? It's almost like it's like a husband and a wife dueling back and forth. Like, are you done? Have we heard enough of your little BS over here? Your truth, your reality that totally contradicts mine, but yours is the one that's believable. Are you done? I mean, that's how it felt. And that's been a lot of that has, in your opinion, I mean, because you've seen both sides of this as a prosecutor and as a defense attorney. Are they overstepping here? Is Alan Jackson like not reading the room very well?
In my view, there's some unnecessary sharpness that he is kind of inflicting on these witnesses. And I don't know if it's scoring them any points. Look, these witnesses didn't ask to be here. Their friend is dead. At least in my appraisal, it looks like Jennifer McCabe is doing the best she can on the stand. There might be inconsistencies, but you want to hammer on only the inconsistencies that matter, not things that someone could easily forget and is on the stand saying, hey, if that's what it is, that's what it is. And then you try to sting them some more, I'm not sure that's the right approach.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like anybody's going, then you made this call, didn't you? I mean, it's like they should like ask Keith Morrison to show up. Like, Keith, can Keith ask the questions just for a little bit? Because it'd be really good. But it feels like he's trying to do that. And then this happened. And it's a big nothing burger. It's like, did you call over to the... Of course she did. Her friend's dead. Or they're trying to figure out where the heck he is or what's going on. It's a frantic search. She's calling everybody. And everybody's calling her. So, again, not that unplausible. In fact, very likely. It'd be weird if no one was calling and she wasn't calling everybody. That would be more questionable of, why weren't you doing this?
Totally. And defense has, since the first trial, tried to raise these specters of, oh, there's some ominous conspiracy, and they can't always really articulate exactly what happened or what they think happened. But I think the jury is going to grow tired of that unless the defense can back it up with some substance. Because, you know, simply suggesting some persons being shady and suspicious, especially under these circumstances where it's just Jen McCabe and her friend died, and it looks like she's doing the best on the stand that she can, I don't think that's going to resonate.
No, and they don't really tie it all together, because once you tie the whole damn conspiracy together and like say it out loud, it sounds insane. We've done it. I've had AI, I've put like all the elements of the case in and just say, unbiased way, explain to me the defense's theory if this house story is true. And then we read it and it's like insane. It wouldn't pass the smell test. Like if you put it out for a script, they'd be like, no, this is not. Because it's nuts. It doesn't make sense. The timelines don't add up. The people, you can't get 40-some people who don't know each other, or a lot of them don't, to all conspire to put their lives and careers and everything on the line in this small town USA to cover up for a fight that an officer who you may or may not know have gotten in with John O'Keefe, to cover him from not being liable for murder, and then to frame his girlfriend. And they all did this in the course of like an hour. And everybody's checking off going, yep, that's it. It goes to insane territory. It especially gets insane when we start seeing arguments and a lot of push on first responders.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.